I want to talk to you today about a little piece of work that I've done recently with Gabriela Barenboim at Fermilab. And she'll be here in a couple of weeks, staying for 3 weeks, so you can talk to her about this work and other things that she's been doing. This will be informal, even by the standards of our talks, in spite of the existence of a computer sitting there. That's just for the images. And so I'd like to begin, because we haven't had a talk about this general subject yet, by telling you a little bit about the generalities of it and how I got involved in it. So the work with Gabriela is to look at the effects of oscillations and decays on the flux of neutrinos that arrive at the Earth from way out there without particular attention to the mechanisms that give rise to those. We've looked at that in other places, and other people are the experts on that. This is one of the targets for the very large volume neutrino detectors. If you make estimates of what the sources of ultra-high energy neutrinos might be, those with energies high enough to peak out from the background of atmospheric neutrinos, so starting at above TeV or a few TeV, and going way up as far as you can go, the most popular conjectured sources for these are AGNs and the processes that take place there, proton-proton or proton-gamma collisions in either the disk or the bright jets around AGNs. These are very powerful sources, and you can take comfort from the notion that at least in a few cases, gamma rays above a few TeV have been spotted in objects like these. Some of the Markarian objects, for example, have been seen in the Whipple Observatory and elsewhere. If you attribute those pretty high energy gamma rays to pi zero decays, then there's a natural calculation that normalizes the flux of neutrinos coming from the charged pion decays. I was here once upon a time for something completely different when there was an AGN workshop going on, and I discovered at drinks one night that there's an intense theological debate between the inverse Compton scattering school and the pion decay school for the sources of these gamma ray, high energy gamma rays. So it's by no means guaranteed. We don't, in fact, know what's going on in the AGNs and what the mechanism for the high energy gamma is. But if you take those as normalization, you can take them, in fact, as a lower bound on the neutrino flux because photons would be intercepted by matter and the neutrinos wouldn't be. So that's, I would say, the most common source that people have discussed. The experts on that are people like Carl Mannheim and Ray Prothero and others who have made, over the years, many kinds of models for what the flux of the neutrinos might be. So my own stumbling on this problem actually came a number of years ago, and it came out of supercollider physics shortly after Eichten and Hinchliffe and Lane and I had written our tome on supercollider physics. I stumbled on a quite interesting paper from the point of view of QCD by Andreev, Berezinski, and Smirnov, who noticed that in contrast to almost all the other illustrations we know about in where the evolution of parton distributions or QCD effects tend to reduce cross-sections as you go to larger and larger energies, larger and larger values of Q squared. This is familiar, for example, in neutrino nucleon scattering at lab energies. They made the very cunning observation that if you're talking about high energy charge current interactions of neutrinos at really high energies, above some tens of TeV for the lab energy of the neutrino, the W propagator actually comes into play. When that happens, it limits, of course, Q squared to be less than something around MW squared. Q squared is related to X times Y times the center of mass energy squared. The distributions in Y aren't doing very much, and so if you're limited as S becomes very large to a finite value of Q squared, it must mean that you're being pushed to smaller and smaller values of X. And those are the places where the effect of QCD is to take all those degraded partons from the valence distribution and boost the distribution at low energy. So they made the observation that this would actually increase the cross-section that you expected at high energies, and they made some rough estimates of what that could be. So when I found this paper and saw how clever they were, it happened that I was one of four people in the world, with Eichten, Hinchliffe, and Lane, who owned parton distributions that for the first time for our supercollider physics applications actually made sense down to pretty small values of x, around 10 to the minus 5 was as far as we went. And for, again, for some of those applications, we had done the first fairly systematic inclusion of heavy flavors, starting with strange bottom, strange charm bottom, into the parton distributions. And those also play a role in this. And so this seemed to be, you know, a little gift to it that had fallen from heaven, that here was a clever observation and I had the tool to pay attention to it. So I did some work with Paul Zerino and Terry Walker at that time. And the first picture I'll show you is just for some orientation of that. This was brilliantly prepared for a dark room, but not so bad. What's plotted here is the cross-section, charge current cross-section for neutrino nucleon scattering, pretty much the same for any neutrino nucleon scattering, as a function of energy, and it's the cross-section divided by energy. So at low energies, the cross-section is proportional to energy. You expect a flat curve, and that's in fact what you get, up to some tens of TeV. Energy here is plotted in GeV. Above tens of TeV, so roughly in the energy range explored at Hera, where they first begun to see in the laboratory the effect of the W boson propagator, the W boson propagator damps the cross-section and it falls off like this, so that roughly speaking over this ultra-high energy range, the cross-section is growing like the 0.4 power of energy or so, rather than the first power of energy. So that's the total cross-section. What's amusing, and this is at the root of the observation of Andrea Ferozinski and Smirnov, is that the contribution of the valence partons, the ones that determine the quantum numbers of the proton itself, is of course dominant at low energy. That's what we all know, and we sort of add in the C distributions just to prove that we're strong people and can get the answer exactly right. But as you go up to higher and higher energy, the fraction of the cross-section that's accounted for by the valence drops off, because you're being squeezed down to the small values of x where the valence distribution doesn't sit. And so you find that you're dominated above some tens of TeV by the C distribution. Here it is. Here are the contributions for different flavors. This is an integral distribution that shows how much of the cross-section is coming from which values of x. So the idea here is that these are normalized distributions, you're integrating the differential cross-section as a function of x up to some maximum value. So if I start with an energy of 10 to the fifth GeV, already pretty high, you can see that at small x, I'm getting next to nothing of the cross-section, and it's only when I get to 0.01 or so in x that I start actually accreting the cross-section. So that's a lot like the situation that we have at laboratory energies. But as you go up in energy, this just scales. And so when you get to 10 to the 7th or 10 to the 9th GeV, some quite high energies, you find that the dominant contribution of cross-section is in fact coming from tiny values of x, places where until recently we haven't had very much control for experiments. You could make extrapolations as we did based on fairly low energy data back in 1984. Now, thanks to the Hera data, we're actually measuring down into these regions and we have some more control over them. So that's why it's not entirely trivial to know what's going on.
Is someone who's ignorant about the subject, is there some simple reason why when the C becomes important, the up and down contributions are dominant over charm and strain?
Yeah, that's because for reasons that Aida and her friends in Lattice QCD will tell us very soon now. Because the up and down quarks are lighter than the others, at low values of Q squared, most of the C is up and down quarks.
Even though you're going to very high energies,
the others are catching up. That's right. The others are catching up. And so you saw in that picture the turn on of charm, for example.
Yeah.
Strange is catching up a little bit, but it's still paying the price for having been. There's my favorite QCD calculation in the world, because you don't need to know anything to do it. Is that to leading order, all of that. So leading log approximation, you can calculate at infinite Q squared what fraction of the momentum is carried by each species. And it becomes, so it's a rational fraction that you can calculate. think 8/17 goes into the glue and the rest is partitioned among the quark flavors democratically. So that's really wonderful, and it tells you that any hadron looks like any other at infinite q squared. But what I'm telling you here is that q squared of 10 to the fourth isn't infinite yet. We haven't caught up with that. It's very slow. Okay, so this is sort of a cross-section plot. It's 1 over a cross-section plot. What I plotted here is 1 over the interaction as the interaction length as a function as in units of centimeters of water equivalent, standard cosmic ray measure. And what's shown here is the total cross-section. Here is a function of energy, the charge current bit here, the neutral current bit there. And this cross-section, or this interaction length, is what you would have gotten in the absence of QCD evolution. So if we just said that at q squared of 5 or 10, we measure the parton distributions, and that's what it is. We don't have a theory that tells us why that's true, but just parton model all the way. That's what you get. And so the insight of Andreev, Beresinski, and Smirnov for this problem is that when you get out here, that makes a big difference by a couple orders of magnitude in what cross-section you might predict, and therefore what event rate and what probability of absorption in various places. I've also marked here as the bright curve the thickness of the Earth diameter. It's about 1.1 times 10 to the 10th centimeters of water equivalent. And so it's fun to talk about these cosmic ray things because my detector friends are always accustomed to measuring how many grams per square centimeter there are in their detector stuff. And here we're talking about tons or kilotons per square centimeter in the column density.
Does that mean that around 40 TeV,
by 1 over E. So that's the place at which, by 1 over E, that's the place that where the Earth thickness is one interaction length. Okay. And so it's true that above about 40 TeV, you start having absorption. This becomes an effect when you build these large detectors. Of course, it's appealing to look down to see the neutrino interactions, so you're not confused by the rain of cosmic ray muons, and so that you know that the things coming up at you are neutrinos. As you get to higher and higher energies in these sources, you can look down, but you're going to see less and less, and so the designers of the big detectors have had to make provision for looking out at larger angles. In the Nestor detector, which is one of the underwater projects in Greece, they even have phototubes looking up as well as down, and there's been a lot of attention over the years to looking off at a little bit above and below the horizon, just for this reason that the neutrinos eat themselves. In fact, there's kind of a compensation within reason. It's true that the absorption is going up. On the other hand, the event rate for the remaining neutrinos is also going up, and so you don't die immediately, but you die pretty fast if you do that. Yeah, I don't know that paper. There was a paper worrying about unitarity in this, which was not right.
Yeah.
I just don't know that paper, so I can't say anything. Okay, so this is neutrino nucleon cross sections, which are the dominant way people imagine observing these things. The first detection method will be to look for the high energy and therefore long range muons that are produced in the charge current interactions of new neutrinos in the detector or maybe in the rock beneath the detector. Over most of the energy range, the cross sections and therefore the interaction rates for scattering on electrons are much smaller, which means the interaction lengths are much larger. But there's this celebrated exception at 6 times 10 to the 6th GeV, so about 6 10 to the 15th electron volts, where the electron eddy neutrino combines with the electron targets to form a direct channel resonance of the W boson, which decays then in the way that it does. So this does really stick out there. It's not very wide. It depends on what the flux of electron neutrinos is and what your energy resolution is. But there are characteristic signatures for that hadron bursts and other flavors and so on that people have talked about. Okay, so that's.
What are all these colors?
Oh, the colors that you can.
And why do the others not make the W?
Because some of them are just new mu-e scattering and things like that. So, but if you stare at it long enough, you can even figure out what the different channels are, because you're a discerning man. Okay. All right, so that's this general business, you know, completely through the QCD parton distribution backdoor is how I noticed that this was something to think about. And by now there are, through the work of the detector developers, through the work of people speculating about sources. So the sources, we said, are presumably AGNs. And there we have people like Prothero and Mannheim and others who have made models of that stuff. A few people, Haley Waxman and John Bacall and others, have imagined that gamma ray bursters might be sources of neutrinos, not in the overall flux, but if you see something coming from the right place at the right time, you might be able to locate that as a point source. Otherwise, it's imagined that you're probably going to be seeing the diffuse glow of the AGNs rather than picking them out one by one, just because the conjectured event rates are pretty small for these. And the experimental projects that we know around the world are AMANDA, which has certainly seen the interactions of atmospheric neutrinos and now awaits its morphing into ice cubed, which is around a kilometer cubed ice detector using Cherenkov radiation and ice, and ought to be able to see stuff peeking out from the atmospheric background. That's, you know, in this wonderful situation that has been blessed by the National Science Board and awaits the director of the National Science Foundation signing a check. So I guess that will happen sometime, but the schedule is not entirely clear. Then there are underwater projects. One that's operating is a small one in Lake Baikal in Siberia, where physicists can actually walk on water 7 or 8 months of the year. And it's during those 7 or 8 months a year that they operate. They actually run the detector when they can go ice fishing and hang their detectors down from the ice. And then when the lake melts, they have to go away for another season. They've seen a few upward-going events, but that's far too small to imagine actually doing serious neutrino astronomy with it. And then there are study projects underway, a couple of which are serious enough that you can imagine they will lead to something. So there's Antares in France, done mainly by people from Marseille in Toulon. Off the coast in Toulon, there is Nestor in Greece, in Pylos. And then there's NEMO in Italy. If any two of these three groups of people would get together, they could rule the world, but they all have their ideas. And it's a property of the topography in the Mediterranean that at many places there are serious cliffs as you approach the ocean. I don't know, actually, you know, there's 4,000 feet back there and sea level here. I don't know whether it applies here. And that actually continues underwater, so you only have to go 10 or so kilometers offshore before you have 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 meter depth in the ocean. And so the idea is to get below a couple of thousand meters of water as a blanket of insulation against the cosmic ray muons. Oh, there was. Uh-huh. Biofouling or oil fouling or something like that. Or they couldn't get by the Coast Commission. No, that.
I have heard that the three European groups have decided that they would join forces should they get the funding to finish the kilometer cube.
That would be great. I know the French and Greek groups fairly well. I know the Italian people less well. And they are serious. They're doing real things. They have test strings and all of that. And I think, unlike Dumann, which was visionary but had maybe 1.2 FTEs working on it for 20 years, these actually have serious groups of people, although each one is too small and fragile by itself to pull it off. But not only do they not have coast commissions, but the ES&H, the safety requirements, are quite remarkable. In Greece, you have these guys walking around under great towers of phototubes and titanium structures and so on, in their sandals, no hard hats. I mean, it's not that a hard hat would do anything for you, but it is the rule around here that you wear one. So it's a very different culture. Okay, so that's the general background, and I'm sure that during the course of the spring, when John Learned is in town and other people, you'll hear more about these things, as we heard several of our colleagues here are thinking about various applications. It is also possible that the atmosphere might be a reasonable target for some kind of ultra-high energy neutrino interactions. The atmosphere down isn't very thick, but horizontally it's not negligible. And so if you can inspect a large volume of the atmosphere, you have a chance of seeing neutrino interactions there. Some calculations of event rates have been done for the Piaget detector that look kind of interesting if the fluxes are high. There are satellite schemes called OWL and USO, much more preliminary. I saw Dave Klein's name on the list, and so he'll be peddling one or both of these when he's here. If you look at enough of the sky, the incorporated volume of stuff is actually very large, and therefore the mass is very large, and maybe you have a chance of doing things. Okay, so last preliminary remark is that, as I mentioned before, the main reaction that people have imagined looking at is neutrino nucleon goes to mu neutrino nucleon goes to muon plus anything. The muon goes kilometers, and so you see it in your detector, and also you may see muons that are produced coming upwards, but produced below your detector. That gives you a little amplification of the effective volume of the detector. That's the thing that's been seen in Amanda and Baikal, studied for the most part. There's talk about seeing electron neutrino interactions. And of course, all of these things are happening at these energies at more or less the same rate. Here, the I think most promising idea I've heard is the fact that at very high energies, when the electron is extremely energetic, its interaction length, the radiation length, is in fact expanded a lot by the Landau-Pomeranchuk-Migdal effect, the coherent damping of the radiation, basically. And so it might actually have a finite flight path within the near crust of the Earth, and then start a torch of electromagnetic showering when it enters the atmosphere. So this may be something that you can look at with the atmospheric detectors. That's not very well developed. For tau neutrinos materializing into tau plus anything, you have the fact that the tau lifetime, when translated into distance, becomes significant at around 10 to the 15th electron volts. Tau travels on average 50 meters or so before decaying. And so there's the celebrated signature of the first shot from the charge current interaction, the second shot from the decay of tau. Whether these can be done with great efficiency, and whether, if the detection can be made, you can characterize reasonably what the energy of the incoming neutrino is, isn't yet known. And for the fantasy I'm going to tell you about with Gabriella, it's important that we be able to measure separately at least the electron fluxes and the muon fluxes, and it would be delightful to also measure the tau neutrino fluxes. So I don't actually know whether these things can be done in a serious way at the moment, and what we'll try to do is show what you could learn if you could do that and what the requirements might be. Okay, so long ago and far away when this subject started, neutrino oscillations had been dreamed about but not seen, and they were thought to be some rare and exotic occurrence. So the general expectation was that if the source is pi decays, in AGN jets or someplace, that the flux at the source should be one-third electron neutrinos, two-thirds muon neutrinos, and no tau neutrinos, to good approximation, as in our accelerator beams that aren't prompt beams. You could imagine variations on this theme in which the pion decays are indeed the source, in the relatively long time before the muons decay and give you the electron neutrinos, something happens to them. They get degraded in energy or something. So maybe you could have a source that's enriched in muons and depleted in electrons. But that was basically it. And what you would then imagine doing is that neutrinos have excellent properties for astronomy we know about. They travel in a straight line. They point back to where they came from. And so you could look back and see what the sources were and characterize the sources in this way. And there were wonderful optimistic scenarios that maybe over the lifetime of one of these detectors, you would detect 5 or 10 tau neutrino events and convince yourself that neutrino oscillations had happened. So that's all changed now because oscillations are known to happen and to happen in a big way. And what we wanted to do was to look at that again. So one thing that you can do for orientation is to note that the oscillation length is tiny on the scale of the cosmos. We already know that because if you just note that the muon atmospheric neutrinos, when they travel 11,000 kilometers, have already changed form, you can increase the energy by a lot and still have a long distance to go. And so this is in the right units for this problem. This is 2.5 times 10 to the minus 24 megaparsecs times the energy of the neutrino in electron volts. So I can measure, I can multiply that by 10 to the 20 or so and still be sure that for any astrophysical source that's not in my backyard and would have vaporized my detector, that there will be many oscillation lengths between now and then. This was taking delta m squared of 10 to the minus 5 electron volts squared, which thankfully we now know is probably the smallest number we have to deal with. Okay, so that means everything's oscillated completely by the time that it gets here. Okay, what to do? Well, for orientation, let's suppose that we have a source of this kind and ask what will become of it by the time that it gets here. You all know that we relate the set of neutrino flavors by the neutrino mixing matrix to the mass eigenstates. From that, and in the limit in which you have infinitely many oscillations, so everything is averaged out, you can easily write down a transfer matrix that maps the mix of neutrinos at the source to the mix that arrives here. It's just sums of products of squares of M and S matrix elements. And one idealized case is worth looking at. So let me take the neutrino mixing matrix in the idealized form to have this form, cosine theta 1, 2, sine theta 1, 2, 0, minus sine theta 1, 2 over root 2, cosine theta 1, 2 over root 2, 1 over root 2, and then the rest of that. So the form that develops if we have maximal atmospheric mixing and if theta 1, 3 is equal to 0, not a bad approximation, but written here for a general solar mixing angle, 1, 2 mixing angle. If you start with this form, which is specific but not infinitely specific because we haven't taken a special form for theta 1, 2, special value for theta 1, 2, then the transfer matrix, we'll call X, has following simple form. It's equal to 1 minus 2x, x, 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 1 half, 1 minus x, where little x is sine squared theta 1, 2, cosine squared theta 1, 2. So again, I don't care what the value of theta 1, 2 is. And this matrix is, in fact, the general matrix that takes the distribution 1 third, 2 thirds, 0 into 1 third, 1 third, 1 third. And so we know, to good approximation, if we start out with a standard source, independent of what the details of solar mixing turn out to be, what that value turns out to be, that you'll be led to a spectrum at Earth which is roughly one-third, one-third, 1/3. This was noticed specifically a couple of years ago for the first time that, or I noticed that people had noticed it for the first time a couple of years ago, that almost any collection of best fit angles that were known at that time would take you somewhere in this neighborhood. And so at that time with Stephen Park and a stagiaire, an intern from École Polytechnique, Hu Antoine, we looked at that stuff a little bit, and I think Stephen was the first to show me this form. It's in fact even more general because the mu's and tau's are completely equivalent here. So you can start out with any distribution that has 1/3 electrons, and you'll end up with 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, including, of course, the distribution of neutrinos that come from Z decays, where you start with equal mixtures, and then there's nothing you can do in oscillations to change that. That's the way it's going to be. So let me now try to show what this means. So here's a ternary plot stolen from metallurgists and other people. So electron, muon, and tau fraction here. And what's plotted as this little ladder of squares is what happens for some favorite value of theta 1/2 that we chose, which I think was theta 1/2 equals 0.57. Where you would land at Earth if you started with a source that has no electron neutrinos, or all electron neutrinos, or in fact in the middle, 1/3 electron neutrinos. And so you toddle along here, and so you might fantasize that at the end of the day, if we could actually make measurements separately of electron and muon fraction, making provisionally the assumption that muons and taus are equal to be checked in some other way, that you would be able to characterize in some way what the source was and to see whether it verifies our assumption that most sources should be 1/3 electron neutrinos and 2/3 muon neutrinos. So, if the room were darker, you would be able to actually see little lines here. So, here at this altitude, you have 30% tau neutrinos. So, tau neutrinos are being measured up from here. This makes use of the brilliant observation that in the middle of a triangle, the sum of the distances to the three sides is a constant.
Right?
Anywhere in the triangle, right? Euclid knew that, or somebody. And so then the muon fraction is measured along this altitude, and the electron fraction along this altitude. And there's a hexagonal honeycomb of lines underlying this, so that if you studied it in a dark room, you could actually read things off. So it's sort of a convenient way of showing three numbers with one spot in a plane, as long as they add up. So there's the magic place that we expect to be. Then we wanted to ask, well, given our present knowledge, which is approximated by this ideal mixing, or this idealized matrix, what do we actually know? And if you start with 1/3, 2/3, this little blue boomerang is the region that is mapped out. This is the light side, this is the dark side, don't care about that. And if you started out with no electron neutrinos, you land somewhere in this land. So they actually overlap a little bit. If you start out with only electron neutrinos, you end up out here in this blue or purple region. So that gives some feeling for what's the robustness of the predictions we could actually make and the possibility of distinguishing one from another. And you can find in our paper what were the numbers we chose. These are supposed to be 95% confidence spaces at the present time, and now in the future, 5 years or so after the next round of experiments are done, and you see that all these spaces basically shrink by a factor of 2 in both dimensions. Theta 1/2 is responsible for this variation, and theta 2/3 is responsible for this variation again. Light side, dark side, light side, dark side, light side, dark side. And so these two things begin to separate, and that's what you'll know of them. Because Gabriella and Joe Licken and Luba Borisov have been engaged in this quixotic search for CPT violation in the neutrinos, they made the rather daring conjecture that CPT might be violated in the neutrino sector and nowhere else, and that the effects of CPT violation might be communicated to us by the neutrinos. So that has, and you can have her talk about that when she comes. So it's not, well, to a cautious person, you recoil in horror from the notion that you have to give up all the usual rules of quantum field theory, but it turns out that you can make a logically self-consistent theory in which you just have to give up locality rather than giving up everything at once. So it's not total madness. Well, I think whether it applies to the neutrino sector or not, maybe there's an idea there about the general behavior of fermions that we should pay attention to. Since Camlan showed that antineutrinos and neutrinos of the electron type don't behave so differently, it's not entirely free to make up such a story. But they're clever people, and so they have been able to find a couple of sets of parameters that accommodate all known data, but make the mixing structure and the mass hierarchy for neutrinos different from antineutrinos. And so I think, you know, at least the value of this is that theoretically it doesn't crumble when you look at it. You can imagine making such a theory even if it's different from what we expect. And it reminds us that until you've tested all of these things, you don't really know them experimentally. It turns out that their particular set of parameters doesn't do a lot for the mixing, or doesn't, well, if you could measure only antineutrinos, here you are. That's different from this. If you have to average neutrinos and antineutrinos, it's not different enough. I think it's fair to say that if CPT violation is discovered in the neutrino sector, it won't be by looking at the mixture of neutrinos that come from AGNs. But this is, but this had the virtue of sending Gabriella to knock on my door and make me think about this problem again for the first time in a couple of years. Okay, so that's that. The other thing that that is fun is that our colleagues, John Beacom and Nicole Bell and others, so I immodestly emphasize that Fermilab is full of very good young people. So Beacom and Bell and others have investigated what happens if there are sources all there, so the same story I've been telling you, but that the neutrinos decay along the way. And they've noticed that most of the constraints that we know about on decays have to do with decays that lead to the emission of photons or something like that, because then you can make up some cosmological story that this would have ruined things. And so they've looked at particular decays in which there are two-body decays into a second neutrino, so heavier neutrino into a light neutrino and a Majorana or something that's light and doesn't do anything that's to observable cosmology yet, and found first that they, John and Nicole, set plausible limits, or sort of showed what limits you might get by studying solar neutrinos on this, and it's not a stupendous limit on the reduced lifetime. It's something like tau over m. Has to be greater than 10 to the minus 4 seconds per electron volt. So not stupendous. And as far as we can tell, and they've looked at this in some detail, at longer lifetimes you don't have, well, we don't know of any other constraints. So from here, as far out as you want to go, it's open. To them, that means a couple of things. One is that even though you have this nice limit, that we know that neutrino decay isn't the dodge that explains why it's not oscillations that are making the solar neutrino problem well, that you've got 7 or 8 orders of magnitude in lifetime, reduced lifetime, that could intrude and change what you expect for the flux of neutrinos coming from AGNs. So that would have two effects. One, of course, if neutrinos are decaying, you may lose them because they'll be degraded in energy, and so effectively they drop out of the spectrum. And the other thing is that it, for the neutrinos that remain, it will change the flavor mix of those. And so they, together with collaborators, noticed that if you consider the two cases of M1 being the lightest and M3 being the lightest, so normal and inverted mass hierarchy. If you take the extreme point of view that the only neutrinos that survive all the way from out there to Earth are the lightest ones, then of course the mix of neutrinos that you get is just given by the square of the neutrino mixing matrix elements for these guys or these guys. And conveniently, those are distinct from each other and also lead to predictions that are characteristically different from what we would expect from oscillations. This little cross out here shows what you would get with our chosen value of theta 1, 2 if only M1 were left, if that were the lightest neutrino. And over here, with no electron neutrinos left, essentially, and equal numbers of mu and tau neutrinos is what you would get in the case of an inverted mass hierarchy. So that's a clever observation and something that, that tells us. I mean, the thing that's amusing to me is that the main interest, the first interest of these neutrino observatories has to be astronomical. It's just identifying sources, seeing if there's anything out there. And I've always thought that it was remote and rather straining the case to allege that you were going to make fundamental physics discoveries in the same way. At the same time that oscillations screw up the nice features of knowing what the source was exactly and changing it here, they open up a richness of what, if lightning strikes, you might find in physics. So that's a nice observation that they made. That's all for non-radiative decays because they allow you to escape scrutiny until now. Okay.
Trying to find out about the sources. So if
right.
you don't make assumptions about the source, then it's hard to learn about the neutrinos.
Well, yes and no. So if I mean, it goes both ways. If I say that, let me make a comment and then I'll come back to that. In this extreme case that you say only one species survives, namely the lightest neutrino by the time you get to Earth, then the source doesn't matter. The source will matter for the absolute rate that you see, but since the three mass eigenstates are produced equally, you know, it doesn't matter. Two of them go away and you get one, and all that matters then is the mixing elements for that, what the portions of electron, muon, and tau are for that. So if you're looking at the mix and not the flux, which we don't have control over anyway, from the sources, then the source doesn't particularly matter for this application. And the object.
But the question is whether you could get that same result.
Ah, exactly.
From some assumption.
Right. So what John and Nicole and collaborators noticed was that this is way out here and this is way out there. And they noticed correctly that both of those are very far away from the canonical place that you expect to get. And so one of the things that we wanted to do was to ask exactly your question. First, to see how this is blurred if you put in our current knowledge about the mixing angles. And so here's what we get for the consequences of decay. And then, and this is one of the reasons that we chose this weird mixture of only electron neutrinos at the source, for which I don't have a physical mechanism that doesn't make me sick, you see that there's actually an overlap between this region and this region at the time. So if you were to see something out here, you would know that something unexpected and unusual was going on, but given the current experimental bounds, you couldn't distinguish between the two. On the other hand, if you see something way over here, that's truly weird, and there is no way with oscillations to get over there. So that's where we are now. This is where we are in 5 years or so. The regions begin to separate, and if you could actually make a measurement sort of comparable in size to these regions, then you would have a chance of not only saying something weird has happened, but I think that it's decays, or I think that it's a weird property of the source. Here is a place where CPT violation actually makes a much bigger effect. But in this case, since the mass hierarchy is different for neutrinos and antineutrinos, you can't really average them because you don't know what the mixture of them will be arriving at Earth. And in order to see the consequences of that, like something way out here for the inverted mass hierarchy, you would actually have to separate the neutrinos and the antineutrinos. I think what this does for this purpose is to give us an example that all the normal physics that we can think about which is oscillations, standard decays, and so on, because it's all tied up with the mixing matrix, the neutrino mixing matrix, populates this line in which the muon and tau fractions are essentially equal. And so weird physics will have the property that it may lead you far away from this line. Okay. So the last thing that we looked at, well, okay.
You said muon and tau, but it's according to your graph, it's the tau and the e.
There is, so yes. No, this is the line.
Equidistant from those two axes. So
right.
Pi tau and pi e, if you're measuring.
No, the e's are measured this way.
Oh,
right?
No,
okay. So this line is.
It strikes me that there are other, other sort of astrophysical handles on this too.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not an indication of something like virons, then the lifetime's that short, you'll have probably significant production of virons in the universe.
Right.
You've got to worry about the end constraints of one sort or another.
Right.
They're probably okay, but who knows? And also, the lifetime's that short in the production of virons. It messes up, it's likely to mess up supernova neutrinos as well.
Mm-hmm.
You never measure the mu and tau components.
Right,
right.
Wouldn't
see it, right?
So, might not see the kind of guys. You say it would mess up detection of the supernova. Right. Not present data.
No, actually, might actually change what happens in the supernova, too,
if you right. Thermally populate a virus. Oh, right. Yeah, if you work out the distances, I told you that the distance to a typical, to the Markarians, for example, is 140 or so megaparsecs. So that's a typical distance to think of for AGN sources. And that, because of the energies involved getting above the atmospheric neutrino background, means that you have seven more orders of magnitude in lifetime. About the same number is true for supernovas, because there you have the correlation of time and space, and so you don't worry about the atmospheric neutrino background. And that, so the enhanced lever that you would have on that is about the same as you would get from these things.
I thought what George was leading to, maybe something else, is that the neutrinos are trapped. And if they decay into myrons, the myrons get out.
Just like in the early universe as well.
Right.
If you thermally populate that myron, sea of myrons, it's dynamically important.
Mm-hmm.
So, the lifetime actually is comparable to the
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically that's right.
Okay.
They're strongly a couple. The point is
absolutely
coupled is that lifetime is pretty short.
Right. Okay. So two more things. One of the things that we wanted to do was to explore in some quantitative detail if you made a measurement somewhere in this plot with some errors, how well could you go back and say the source really is one-third, two-thirds, or something different. And so there's a little section in our paper about that that requires staring at a plot for a long time. So let me just say that if you could make 30, if you found yourself in the expected range, but you could only make, a 30% measurement of the electron neutrino fraction, you can say next to nothing about what the source was, just because oscillations like to focus them down. If you could ever make a 10% measurement of that, then you begin to have some discrimination. And of course, the more you're living out here or living down here, the better chance that you have of saying that something non-standard has happened at the source.
If you measure the fraction, you have to measure all three.
Well, I think to really measure it, you have to measure all three. However, if you assume mu and tau to be the same and then say, well, I'll check that someday or see that it's not so different, I think that's the way you would get started. Right. Okay, so the last part of the exercise was then to say, well, suppose you're not only so lucky or unlucky to have neutrinos decay, but they don't decay with a lifetime that's so short that they've all gone away by the time they get here, but that as happens with cosmic ray muons, the low energy ones decay, and so you see their products, and the high-energy ones remain as muons. And so you can make that up. Why isn't this totally mad? It's not totally mad because the distances to plausible sources only range over an order of magnitude or so in distance, just because the further away you go, the darker they get. whereas the energies over which you imagine being able to measure these things range over 4 or 5 orders of magnitude, and so there is a chance of seeing L over E change significantly. Of course, you're going to have to make assumptions about the 2 heavier species and how they decay. Of course, there are going to be some smearing because of the different distances to the sources and so on. But for a first look, you can do an idealized case and see how it would look. And it's kind of fun. So here's what we get. And I've made some choice for this, which I guess is the plot is for 10 to the fourth seconds per EV and for a distance of 100 megaparsecs, so it's easy to scale. So if those were the parameters, then you have this wonderful circumstance that at high energies, the neutrinos are arriving as they were sent out. And so you have basically the expected equal mixture of electron, muon, and tau neutrinos. But at low energies, you have the strange outlier mixture that John and Nicole and company talked about. And so you might even imagine, if you could make the measurement as a function of energy, of seeing this transition region, and if the blurring weren't too great, even arriving at some estimate of the lifetime for that. So this turns out to be a universal curve. If you just rescale this, you can change it to different lifetimes and different distances quite easily. So there it is for the normal case and for the inverted case.
Separate?
Pardon?
Why do you and tau separate?
Oh, because we got a teeny tiny difference from pi over 4 for the 2-3 mixing angle for our best. We took Alexei's latest fit or something like that. So at the level of that detail, I think we'll have to wait for future experiments to rule. Okay, here's the inverted case. So now you can't distinguish happily. And so this has the, if we come back to our ternary plots, this has the amusing feature that the fraction that you measure would actually march as a function of energy. So here for my particular choice of parameters, 10 to the 15th electron volts you're standing here. And then you go up half an order of magnitude and you move next to nothing, but over the next decade you move all the way down here. And that would surely be an interesting observation and one that would tell you that something quite interesting was going on. Again, one should be so lucky as to see something like this, and then to have to raise the problem, well, does this mean different kinds of sources are coming in, or weird behavior of that sort, or what exactly is doing it? If you start out far out enough, as you do in this case, with a pure decay spectrum that can't be reached by oscillation, then you have a sign that that's what's going on. So that's how we spent our Christmas vacation.